Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady, or the inventor of the hashtag More Vegetables Than a Vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size, and self-love, and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Valentine, the PaleoMom.com. I'm the New York Times best-selling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up, and you get to listen to our gossip.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It feels like a really long time since we last talked. I know it hasn't been that long, especially given how often we text each other. But I don't know. Maybe my life's been really busy lately.
Daylight saving time hour messing with you?
That must be it. Lost an hour, therefore the world feels like time's going slow. That makes no sense.
It does, because I said it, so it must be right.
Okay, well, there you go.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm getting ready. This weekend I'm going to be in Vancouver, Washington, as a keynote for the Nutrition Therapy Association big conference.
Yeah. A lot of our favorite paleo people are NTPs. That's exciting.
And the keynotes are drawing pretty heavily from the paleo community as well, because Chris Kressler is another keynote and Terry Walls is another keynote. So, and I just have to say, like, wow, it's really so awesome. It's so awesome when I see my name, like, in those lists of people. Like, it just, I know for our listeners, you know, a lot of people are like, well, of course your name's up there with those people. But for me, I still get like shivers, because, it's just really exciting for me to, you know, be recognized as a thought leader in the paleo movement. That wasn't something that I really sought out to achieve when I started my blog. But it's something that, you know, I feel really passionately about a lot of issues, and I think that my voice is a really good contribution to the discussion. So it's just really wonderful when I have that recognition, and when I stir up massive controversy, which I also did this week. Did you see the massive controversy?
No, I have missed what you've stirred this week. It's something new every other day, seemingly.
So, well, yeah, I guess that's it. I've got some opinions about some things that...
we can just leave it at that. You and I both have some opinions on some things.
Yeah. They're either not the mainstream opinion, or in my case, it's the opposite of the other extreme opinion. So I'm a counterbalance. So, you know, people who have listened to our show or who have heard me talk or have asked me a question about ketogenic diets know that I am not a fan, except for in a few very, very specific therapeutic applications. And that while I see that there are benefits to certain systems in the body, when you take a whole body systems approach to evaluating the merits of a ketogenic diet, I think there's as many cons as there are pros. And we talked about this at our joint presentation at AHS, and people can go and we can make sure Monica puts a link to the presentation on YouTube, and they can go and listen to our presentation from AHS, where we talked about specifically some of the really popular biohacks in the paleo movement and why they're not necessarily appropriate for women. I'm actually going to be talking really specifically about ketogenic diets, and not just why they may not be appropriate for women, but who else they may not be appropriate for and why, and really get into the nitty-gritty science in my, like, explaining for everyone in the room type way. But I'm going to be really providing, I believe, the counter argument to what I see as being a very, very strong pro-ketogenic diet sort of voice in the community. And I have some really deep concerns about ketogenic diets, and I have voiced them. I went on Jimmy Moore's podcast and we had a discussion about them, and I was able to voice, you know, my concerns there. But I think it's time for me to really do it in a way that's like, here's the slide explaining the science. And I haven't had the opportunity to do that. But because I think the organizers know that this is a controversial topic, and somebody coming out against ketogenic diets is going to draw a crowd, they put me on the keynote stage at PaleoFX, which is then has all of the pro ketogenic diet people extremely upset that, you know, my talk that's going to vilify the ketogenic diet is getting so much press and get so much attention.
Okay,
and
can we just pause for a moment? Mm-hmm. Because I think any argument that is based on the premise of the word vilify is already one of, for me as an impartial third party, I would tend to err on the side of, well, that's an emotional response.
Well, and anybody who knows me knows that vilify is the completely wrong word to describe anything that I say. So, you know, what I've said is I'm not going to be talking outside the boundaries of scientific evidence. And I'm going to be presenting, I think, the pros and the cons. But what I want to do is I want to educate people on the cons, because I don't think and the, you know, the potentially extremely serious effects and life-threatening effects that can happen from ketogenic diets for certain people. And so, you know, I want to make sure that that's part of the education, because I don't see it being out there right now. I see a lot of people saying ketogenic diets are panacea, they're a cure-all, they are the answer to everything. And I disagree. I disagree based on the scientific research that I've read, and I'm going to be talking about that publicly. I think finally, you know, last year when I was at PaleoFX, I was really,
you were very veiled.
I was living in a world of just finished a book, still working on another book.
Yeah.
And I got there and I didn't even see it coming. And I was absolutely shocked at how many pro ketogenic diet talks there were. And I felt that AHS last year did a better job of sort of presenting some pros and cons. But at the same time, there's just this part of the community that's really, really passionate about it. And I don't want to detract from anybody's individual success with that as an approach. But I believe that the research really shows some strong and compelling reasons to be extremely cautious and to not recommend this as a general diet approach for the average person. And so, so I kind of feel, I feel like because the ability to read those scientific papers and at the level of detail that I am able to read and understand them is not a particularly common skill. And so because that I have the ability to understand such exquisite detail about the biological systems, I feel like it's my responsibility to be a bit of a whistleblower. And so, I do think that my talk will be very balanced, and it is going to present pros and cons of ketogenic diet and what are some of the benefits, what are the risks, but I really feel like that education needs to be out there. So it's caused a stir, which is going to, of course, have the net effect of even more people coming to my talk. So no pressure on me. But that's ever since PaleoFX posted their schedule earlier this week, it has angered some people. And
they don't even know the name that you were originally going to call that.
And we don't need to share that anywhere.
So I will make sure that it's on my calendar to attend, because it's just fascinating to me how much the community can claim to use science for what we're doing with our lifestyles in simplified terms. But then when science doesn't support what we're doing, and I'll give another example, and this is along the same lines of ketogenic, where, you know, the medical literature came out and showed that cancer can actually be caused by eating a meat-centric diet, and that vegetables were incredibly important. And it echoed what you and I have been saying, hashtag more vegetables than vegetarian, for a long time. That, however, the research indicates that if you're eating antioxidant-rich vegetables and fruits associated with the consumption of that meat protein, that it balances out the risk and no longer shows cause for cancer. So, but I remember when that article came out and there were like a bazillion paleo people just outraged and saying things like, well, they didn't test grass-fed meats. Well, that's neither here nor there in the medical science of what the argument was and what the basis of that scientific literature is. And I think we've got a similar case here where, you know, for some people, for some amount of time, ketogenic can work well. And, you know, I know where we're kind of going with the show. So I'll say, I think it's a good bridge to kind of talk about, you know, that didn't work for me in the capacity of my long-term health, but it did work for me in terms of weight loss. And, you know, for me, when I was losing weight on an extremely low-carb ketogenic diet and intermittent fasting, and I was losing my health, which triggered an autoimmune flare, none of that was known or understood by me or my doctors at the time. It was like, oh, well, you've got post-nursing depression and, you know, you're not digesting your foods because you don't have a gallbladder and this and this and this. And those things helped. But, you know, looking back, not nourishing my body with the proper nutrients that it needs, mainly, you know, fiber and vegetable-rich carbohydrate.
And all of that, I think we really, because we don't understand the roles that most phytochemicals play in our health, you know, they're not labeled as essential nutrients because we don't know exactly what they do in the body, but there's this huge body of scientific literature showing that the more plant phytochemicals you eat, the, you know, better your health is overall and the lower your risk of disease. And I think we underestimate the value of these. Most of them are antioxidants. Some of them are vitamin-like compounds. We underestimate the value of them because we don't understand them. There's so many different ones and we just don't understand exactly what they do. Therefore, I guess they're not important. I mean, that's sort of the current assumption because we don't know what they all do. Then, you know, we don't focus on them, but we understand what basic vitamins and minerals and carbohydrates and protein and fat do.
Well, yes, but also I think even to simplify that even more, like we know that vitamins and minerals are essential to our health, and it's impossible unless you're seeking out eating, you know, the thyroid gland of animals, which I can't even get in my state, so I don't know how someone's doing that on a regular basis, to get all of your vitamins and minerals from protein-based sources. And, you know, I have seen that there is detriment to health when people aren't eating nutrient-rich food. And we talk about all the time, you know, we talk about the tribes that the diet can base itself off of. We talk about the scientific literature of how important nutrients are, like you just said. And so we're all in agreement, right? We can all stand in a room and hold hands and sing kumbaya about the importance of nutrients. But then when we say, okay, what nutrients are you talking about? We all kind of have a different sense of opinion on what that is. And absolutely, you and I both agree that bone broth and organ meat and seafood and pastured eggs and grass-fed ruminant animals are incredibly...
More vegetables than a vegetarian.
Right. Those are all really great sources of nutrients, but there's this other set of food that people seem to forget is just as important as those other nutrient-rich sources. And that's where my hashtag more vegetables than a vegetarian comes from, because I have to eat those to feel good. And I know you feel good when you eat them. And I think it's important to understand that you can't be ketogenic and eating a ton of vegetables, which is really unfortunate because, like, if, you know, if you're going to talk about the context of low carbohydrate and how that could work with someone, especially if they're focused on eating, you know, fiber rich leafy green vegetables on a regular basis, then it's a different conversation.
Very different conversation.
Right. And maybe that's what people need to hear because it's not the same. And so where I was kind of going with this is I think there's the same kind of, confusion in the community based on early understanding of what an autoimmune paleo protocol is, right? We're on this thing of myth busting. So rather than going down the ketogenic wormhole, which I feel like maybe we already did, but oh well, just a teaser of what's to come, I think it would be good to talk about this misunderstanding of what people who have specifically thyroid problems or in general an autoimmune protocol, and I'm using kind of quotations because there's different definitions for that, an autoimmune protocol looks like in terms of what should or shouldn't be consumed. And again, you know, I have heard from people so many times in social media and in the blog comments and emails about, you know, why are you putting seaweed salt on your food because it has iodine and you have thyroid problem? And, you know, different things about goitrogenic vegetables and food with fiber and all that kind of stuff, people being afraid of those foods for their autoimmune health. And I think, you know, getting into the value of those foods and what medical research you found that either does or doesn't support some of those myths would be a good kind of jumping off point from our ketogenic soapbox.
And I think actually we've probably got two or three different podcast episodes in that arena. And I think that, the thing that I want to emphasize, before we get into some of the more nuances, is this huge, vast body of literature showing that the higher your vegetable consumption or higher your vegetable and fruit consumption, the lower your risk of health problems. And when you couple that with studies of hunter-gatherers, the majority of which regularly consume between 100 and 200 different species of plants, mostly can be described as fruits or vegetables. And most hunter-gatherer populations, this is both contemporarily studied and historically studied, consumed an estimate of between 50 and 200 grams of fiber a day. And when I was trying to figure out, like, how much vegetables would you have to eat to hit that 50-gram mark on a ketogenic diet? And if you went with spinach, which was, like, the highest fiber to carbohydrate ratio I could find, so, like, the lowest carbohydrates for how much fiber you were getting, I mean, it's basically half, you know, 1-to-1. So, you know, one part fiber to one part non-fiber carbohydrates. So you'd have to eat, it was like 20 cups of spinach a day or something like that. I can't remember what the exact number was. But you'd have to eat 50 grams of, you know, it'd be 100 grams net carbohydrate, 100 grams gross carbohydrate, 50 grams net. So it'd be 50 grams of sugars for your 50 grams of fiber, which kicks you out of ketosis, right? That is too many carbohydrates to kick you out of ketosis to meet this like bottom of the range fiber content for what hunter-gatherers consume. You know, and clearly the Eskimo are an extreme example, but they're also like an extreme. You don't base an entire way of eating based on the extreme example. You base it based on the average. So I think there's a lot of really interesting myth busting that we can do within this topic of thyroid health. We can talk about the original autoimmune protocol. You know, it really came with Rob Wolf talking with Lauren Cordaine, trying to figure out, you know, where the cutoff was in some of these gray area foods. So, you know, when I'm talking about how to assemble a diet and a set of recommendations, when I look at food, I look at what's good in it, which basically means the nutrients, vitamins, minerals, phytochemicals, essential amino acids, essential fatty acids, and fiber. So you look at what is health promoting in that food, and you look at what might cause a problem. So inflammatory compounds, gut irritants, compounds that are difficult to digest, you know, feed the wrong kind of bacteria in the gut, anti-nutrients. So you look at what might not be good. And, you know, foods on a paleo diet, the for sure, like, way yes, awesome foods that we can all agree on are the foods that have tons of nutrition and very little to no potentially problematic compounds. And the foods that are way no's, right, like wheat or like soy or like peanuts, are the ones that have lots of potentially problematic compounds and not a whole lot of nutritional redeeming features. And then there's this whole area of gray in between, where you've got maybe not as much nutrients, maybe some problematic compounds, and where you cut that off, you know, where you say this is my individual tolerance, is where within the paleo diet we're talking about foods that you get to experiment with. So once you've kind of gone through a strict paleo diet for a little while and kind of cleaned out your system, we start experimenting with rice. We start experimenting with high quality dairy. We start experimenting maybe with traditionally prepared legumes. I mean, these things that you're starting to see pop up in the paleo community as, you know, maybe foods that are working for some people. And it's because of this cutoff of how much good to how much bad one person can tolerate. And it's also what you can tolerate versus what you need to thrive. And I think that finding that range for each of us is what we mean by individual experimentation and figuring, you know, our own N equals one experiments and figuring out what we need for us. And I think that when you're looking at a food and trying to decide where that cutoff is, history of chronic illness is probably going to mean that you need to do your cutoff at a slightly stricter point than someone who's coming into paleo perfectly healthy and is just doing this for optimal performance and longevity. So you're going to pick a food that has a lot more nutrition in it and a lot fewer potentially problematic substances. So that's where the autoimmune protocol comes from. So it comes from making that cutoff a little bit stricter than standard paleo diet. So we start cutting off nightshades because they have some extremely potent adjuvants in them. So compounds that can stimulate the immune system, get the immune system ramped up in a very non-specific way. And even though they have a lot of nutrition, these inflammatory compounds are a problem, and they tend to be a problem for people with autoimmune disease and other chronic health problems. We cut out eggs because eggs can potentially impact the gut barrier and help, you know, there's a protein in egg whites that can help bring stuff across the gut barrier, sort of like a piggyback, gives it a piggyback into the body and stimulate the immune system. We cut out nuts because of the high rate of food sensitivities to nuts and because they're high in omega-6s and pretty high in anti-nutrients, hard to digest. And so the AIP started with this list of no's, and it did not, there was never a focus on what do you eat more of. And just how important nutrient density was. And that's a relatively new concept within the autoimmune protocol. And I guess, you know, it was really ushered in by me, although I was not the only person talking about those types of important aspects of health at the time.
I think Rob Wolf had like a paragraph in his book.
Yeah, a half page little text box. What if you have autoimmune disease? And it was a list of other things to avoid. And he didn't even say all nightshades. I think he said like peppers, tomatoes, eggplant. And I don't know that he said, I think he said nuts and eggs and wine and NSAIDs, I think. Lauren Credane had a different list on the paleodiet.com. And then when I started trying to research the autoimmune protocol in very, very beginning of 2012, there was precisely two websites that basically combined Lauren Credane's list and Rob's list. And that's where you got nightshades, NSAIDs, which are drugs like aspirin, alcohol, nuts and eggs, and this extra and nuts and seeds and eggs, this extra list of things to avoid. And when it was first sort of filled out in terms of additional foods to avoid, I think was in Practical Paleo by Dan Sanfilippo. And there were some, you know, unfortunately, some recommendations that were rolled into the autoimmune protocol in that book that upon more detailed examination of the scientific literature were not correct. And through no fault of Diane's, she was representing, I think, what was sort of the state of our understanding as a community at the time. And it took people like me really going into the science in a lot more detail, people like Terry Walls really going into science in more detail to sort of debunk these myths that were really prevalent in the community at the time that Practical Paleo was published. And so there was two, I think, really important ones. I think one we can talk about, or maybe even we want to talk about both of them in more detail in a future podcast, but one was to avoid especially leafy greens and vegetables that are rich in insoluble fiber if you have any kind of digestive problems. And unfortunately, the research really doesn't bear that out. And in fact, the scientific research shows the exact opposite. So it shows that for gut pathologies like ulcerative colitis and diverticulosis, that insoluble fiber is actually healing. And so there was at the time, and actually I believe it's still very prevalent in the alternative health community, that there's this idea that because I think when people have digestive distress, you can identify, say, particles of kale in your stool pretty readily. There's this idea that they're irritating or they must be like sandpaper. And in contrast, the scientific literature shows that insoluble fiber, which is the dominant fiber type in leafy vegetables, is actually anti-inflammatory and healing for the gut. And that if you, for example, have a risk of diverticulosis in your family, you want to prevent that in old age, when the best things you can do is have a diet that's rich in a variety of sources of insoluble fiber, so rich in a ton of non-starchy vegetables. And we actually know in some mechanistic studies that insoluble fiber is actually far more healing for the gut and anti-inflammatory in sort of examples of diverticulosis and ulcerative colitis than soluble fiber. And it can actually be used therapeutically. So it's almost the exact opposite. So, you know, if people are having such poor stool quality that they're seeing, you know, bits of kale in their stool, there's other places to troubleshoot than eliminating insoluble fiber from their diet. And sort of the simplest one, just for anybody who's listening to this going, but I need more information, the simplest one is to actually cook those sources of insoluble fiber, which starts to partially break down the fiber and makes those foods much easier to digest.
Which I'll tell you is what I have to do because my digestive function can't handle.
Well, and you know, it's a very classic, a classic sign of gut dysbiosis, not having the right kind of bacteria in our digestive tracts that are supposed to break down that fiber, as well as insufficient pancreatic enzymes to help break down carbohydrates. And so there's a couple of different places to troubleshoot there, which is supporting the right diversity of gut bacteria. And you can't support growing the type of bacteria that break down those insoluble fibers without eating insoluble fiber, because you need to eat the food that those bacteria like. If you cut out insoluble fiber, you starve those bacteria and then you don't have any, and then you make the problem even worse. So there's ways to sort of slowly build up the amount you're eating, consume it to start with fermented and cooked, so it's partially broken down, working on probiotics, working on digestive enzyme support. Like, there's a lot of other places to troubleshoot if that's a situation that you're dealing with than cutting out those foods. And it just so happens that those non-starchy vegetables are a tremendous source of nutrients that our immune systems need to function normally, that our body needs to be able to heal itself, that helps reduce inflammation. So it's one of the recommendations that comes out of alternative health that has actually led to sort of what I think of as veggie phobia. And I see veggie phobia very rampant in the autoimmune community. The other, I think, erroneous recommendation from Practical Paleo was to avoid what are sort of termed goitrogenic vegetables, which really includes the entire brassica family. So that's cruciferous vegetables, cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, kale, arugula, turnips, that entire family of vegetables. And then there's some other ones, like I remember spinach I think strawberries are on the list, but I'm not 100% sure. But there's this list of really nutrient-dense vegetables, some of the healthiest vegetables that we can eat. And kale has more nutrients per calorie than just about any plant, you know, with the exception of going into like wild plants, right? So we're cutting out some of the most nutrient-dense vegetables for fear that they're going to suppress thyroid function. And when you actually go back and look at the literature, what the literature shows, it was originally done actually in rabbits, and it showed that if they fed them tons of cabbage, they got goiters. But these rabbits were incredibly iodine deficient. And when you actually go back and look at human populations that are getting goiters from these goitrogenic vegetables, they're all iodine deficient. And as soon as you're not iodine deficient, these vegetables don't suppress the thyroid. And in fact, there's a mild stimulatory action from these compounds on the thyroid. So they can actually help thyroid production if you're not iodine deficient. And it's very probable that selenium deficiency is also important here. And so iodine is a fantastic segue into really what this podcast is about, which is the relationship between iodine and thyroid function, because we have had, since our diagnoses of Hashimoto's thyroiditis, had like a billion
questions. I mean, maybe just like too short of a billion,
right?
But yeah,
I was gonna be like, that's 999 million, and I was like, no, I was starting to think about how many nines that would be, and then I was like, that's too much. I can't say all that.
I think they got the joke,
right? You know, I think that, you know, talking about, I would love to do a fiber show at some point. So that's definitely in our works. And we can even talk more mechanistics about the goitrogenic vegetables for people who have thyroid disease and have heard that they can't eat cabbage, or they can only have broccoli if it's cooked, or all of these sort of myths. But really, it comes down to the importance of iodine.
Can I just interrupt you for a second to point out that you do cover all of this in your massive encyclopedic book, The Paleo Approach?
I do. And in fact, people can go and read more information about the goitrogenic vegetables on page 209. I know
fiber is in there and on your blog. I know goitrogenic vegetables is in the book. I don't know if that's on your blog, but if you Google the Paleo Mom and then whatever scientific reference you're looking for, I will send you a signed copy of my book if you can't find any references at all to what you're looking for. Because I'm willing to bet that much that it's out there.
You just
are someone
signed copies of your book to all the Google deficient people out there.
Well, I specifically said if they Google it and they don't get a result, they've got to show me that there's no result. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a list for Sarah of all the posts that she needs to write. Because she's got nothing on her to-do list. I'm going to cap that at like two or three, by the way, because you're right. I'll get some insanity.
So, so both of those topics are discussed in the book. Fiber, the post, it's a 5-part series on my blog called The Fiber Manifesto. And I really recommend people read it. It's a nutrient that is not considered essential, but I think ridiculously, stupidly so. And you guys know I don't use the S word very often. So I think that as we understand the importance of the microbiome, I think to think that their food is not an essential nutrient for us is just a really a short-sighted view of human health. So I should start campaigning for fiber to be added to the essential nutrients list. So that's just a really detailed series, and has it, that particular series busts a ton of myths within those 5 posts. So all things that we can eventually talk about on the show, but if you can't wait, Fiber Manifesto, goitrogenic vegetable post on my site, and of course the book. So let's talk about iodine. I know we've done like a lot of science in our like lead up, but let's actually do science with Sarah about iodine.
I think it's hysterical that you're about to do science with Sarah, because I'm like, wait, we're like done with this show, right? We've done a ton of science.
yes. So we're just going to ramp it up. Actually, you know what's going to be really funny? I'm going to let you find out in science with Sarah.
All right.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
So, as much as this is part of our general myth-busting show, we really wanted to focus on iodine because of the huge number of questions that we had about iodine, especially supplementation, and the two sort of extreme recommendations with thyroid disease: supplementation with huge doses of iodine versus completely avoiding dietary iodine. You see both of those recommendations from different types of doctors when you have thyroid disease diagnoses. So why is iodine important? So as sciencey as this is to say, iodine is important because it's part of the molecular structure of thyroid hormone. That is as simple as it gets. And that's all there is to it. So the prohormone thyroxine has 4 iodine molecules as part of its molecular structure. When it's converted into the active form of thyroid hormone, triiodothyronine. You can probably guess from the name of what T3 is, triiodo, that it's got 3 iodines in it. So iodine is part of the molecular structure of thyroid hormones, and thyroid hormones, as you've heard on our thyroid-themed shows that we seem to be doing many of all of a sudden this year, has an essential role in just about every aspect of health. So if you don't have iodine, you can't make thyroid hormones. What's really interesting is there's a lot of extra nutrients that are involved in various reactions around here, which we've also already talked about. Zinc is really important for thyroid health, even though we don't exactly know the mechanism of how zinc is working. There's a really important enzyme that helps deal with excess iodine, which is based on selenium. So selenium becomes extremely important for both actually thyroid hormone production, but also the conversion of T4 to T3 and then handling the excess iodine at the end. So there's a ton of selenium proteins that are at work here. And there are iron-based enzymes that are really, really important for the production of thyroid hormones as well. So you've got this these 4 minerals that are known to be extremely important for thyroid health. But when it comes to iodine, it's really interesting because there's not a really good consensus on how much iodine we need. So let's start with what the USDA guidelines are. They recommend between 150 to 220 micrograms of daily iodine. And where that number comes from is how rampant goiters were prior to 1920 when they invented iodized salt. So prior to 1920, you look in the Great Lakes area, the Appalachians, the northwestern states, and most of Canada, goiters were extremely common. They figured out iodized salt, goiters pretty much went away. And so they basically found through this mass population experiment that 150 micrograms was sort of like this minimum amount of iodine needed for thyroids to function well enough to not produce goiters. There's been a variety of other studies that have looked at very healthy populations, especially looking at the Japanese, which tend to have far fewer issues with chronic health disease than we do, and how much seafood and especially sea vegetables in their diet, and estimating how much iodine they get. The initial studies that did that really showed that it was like a lot, like 12 to 13 milligrams. So a milligram is 1,000 times more than a microgram. So we're talking about the math is like 100 to 200 times more iodine per day than the USDA guidelines. However, more recent studies show that that was probably an overestimate, and that it's probably more like 1 to 3 milligrams. Now, that's still about 10 times more than what the USDA sort of recommends as its recommended daily allowance. But it's a lot of iodine. Now, here's the catch. Consuming that much iodine requires these other really important minerals for thyroid function. So it requires iron, it requires zinc, it requires selenium. And it just so happens when you look at the Japanese diet, seafood tends to be really high in all of those minerals. So when you're consuming the excess iodine, you're consuming everything your body needs to be able to process it properly. So even if 1 to 3 milligrams is a lot, and there's no consensus on whether or not it is, because a lot of people believe that's actually where we should be aiming. Part of the key here is they're consuming that much iodine with these other minerals. And that changes the discussion. So when we start talking about really high-dose iodine supplementation, it should be noted that high-dose supplementation, so it's recommended very typically for hypothyroidism, it's like 12 to 50,000 micrograms. The original recommendations were not based on science. So that's really, really important to understand. And it's really important to understand that that really excessive high level of iodine, especially without selenium, zinc, and iron, can cause a variety of problems, including thyroid disease. So it probably doesn't actually cause thyroid disease. It probably tips the balance on thyroid disease that's already developing, but it's known to, let's say, worsen or make diagnosable hypothyroidism and hyperthyroidism. And there's some other health conditions that can crop up as well. So the alternative health community is really moving away from the high-dose iodine supplements, and definitely there is a convincing enough body of literature to show that it can cause some really serious adverse effects. The only time I would recommend, I'm going to use the word recommend even though it's not quite what I mean, the only time where I think iodine supplementation is appropriate is with diagnosed deficiency. So you have your levels measured and you know that you're deficient. And then I think that it's a far better strategy to seek out whole food sources of iodine, because you're getting these other really important thyroid health minerals. So you're getting the other things that your body needs to process iodine. So looking at sea vegetables, seafood, as opposed to iodine in a pill without all of these other really important minerals. So how much iodine we need is not really very well understood. At least 150 micrograms. If we're getting this nutrient dense diet with lots of seafoods, so we're getting these other minerals, 1 to 3 milligrams is clearly conducive to good health. Excessive amounts, especially in the absence of these minerals, causes a problem. Did I touch on everything on iodine that I needed to there?
I think so. I mean, essentially, I'm going to go back to my very simple answer of, dude, it's kelp.
Super kelp.
Super, super healthy. Sarah says so. So, no, I mean, in all seriousness, I think that you did. It's never been a concern for me. In fact, I specifically put kelp salt on my food because one of the things that I learned when I first went paleo is that, like vitamin D deficiency, iodine deficiency is very common for people who give up processed foods, because there is so much iodized salt in the processed foods that most Americans are eating. That's where they're getting their iodine. And so when people go on a real foods, whole foods, paleo diet, there's often a lack of iodine in the foods that they eat. And so I specifically sought out a whole food product that I could utilize in order to not be iodine deficient. And I really, really like sea vegetables. I like sea vegetables more than I like seafood, to be perfectly honest. So, you know, anytime I have the chance to find a palatable way to eat seaweed or any sea vegetable, really, I don't worry about it, because, like you said, a whole food source is synergistic in the way that it's going into your body, and so there's much less concern for me in terms of, you know, overdose on a certain component. So I like it. I like it when you tell me that I'm right. That's all.
Yeah, and I think you had a very, very good point that I missed, which is that one of the things that happens when people, it's not just paleo diet, but it's whole foods diet, you see it on vegetarian, vegan, is any diet where you're really sort of eschewing the manufactured foods, it's very, very common for people to switch to sea salt, kosher salt. And these are, many of them are semi-refined, if not completely refined. And I don't think people really understand that when you buy sea salt in your regular old grocery store, it's still refined. So it doesn't have the trace mineral content that unrefined sea salt would have. And there's lots of beneficial trace minerals. That unrefined sea salt has lots of good stuff in it. And it's not iodized. So you're missing out on the iodine as well as all the trace minerals. So you're basically getting sodium and chloride. And then you have to worry about, you know, what sodium is doing in your body without all of these other really important electrolytes and other important minerals. So when we look at like how sodium causes or correlates with high blood pressure, we know that that mechanism can only happen when you're potassium deficient. So it's not so much a problem of excess sodium as it is excess sodium in the context of not enough potassium. And this is a really common theme. Like we just talked about that with iodine and selenium. Same thing happens with sort of vitamin A and vitamin D. We know that there's many, many, many mineral or nutrient sort of pairings or triplets in the human body where you really need all, you know, both or all three or all four in order to have a system work properly. And it's why whole foods and unrefined foods become so important, because it just so happens very handily for us that nature tends to provide those synergistic quantities of the different nutrients when we focus on a variety of high quality whole foods. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why you and I are constantly saying nutrient density, nutrient density, nutrient density, because when you eat that way, you stop having to think about, well, should I take an iodine supplement now that I have Hashimoto's, or should I be avoiding iodine? I think that's going to be our next question. So that would be a really great place to go now.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
So our first question is from Julie, and Julie writes, I see you recommend iodized sea salt as one of Stacy's favorites. Is this not contraindicated with Hashimoto's? Just want to make sure she's not harming herself or causing a goiter by overdoing the kelp and sea veg. By the way, your podcast is my absolute favorite, and I subscribe to many. I am super excited every time a new one pops up. Thanks for always delivering every week. I can only imagine the type of commitment required to accomplish this feat.
Thank you, Julie. You know how I feel about compliments and questions getting onto the show.
And I really appreciate the acknowledgement that we've never missed an episode.
It's kind of a big deal. I mean, you and I have like...
I have out-of-town company right now who is sitting in my living room twiddling her thumbs. And I was trying to explain, like, I have to do this because I've never missed an episode. Like...
Yeah, I abandoned my child with my sister earlier this evening so that I could come do it as well. So we are committed to this show in a way that's kind of disturbing.
A little bit mentally ill.
Matt runs a tight ship. We've tried to skip before and Matt's yelled at us. So
right. Well, Matt's basically said, now that you've never missed a week in over 2 years, you just can't.
Right. So you can thank him for the weekly
for being
commitment.
A bit of a
okay, so I just want to clarify. Julie says that our blog, me, that I recommend iodized sea salt as one of my favorites. I have a page on our blog we can link to that is like our recommended resources, and I guess technically you could call it iodized sea salt, but it is not iodized. It is sea vegetable sea salt. So they take sea vegetables and they grind them up and then they mix them. I think it's a 50-50 ratio to sea salt. And that is what I put on like my eggs and my soup and my salads once or twice a day in relatively small quantities. It's how I'm making sure that I'm getting a natural synergistic form of iodine that we talked about earlier. To the point that, you know, we spoke about just a moment ago, I mean, like most minerals and vitamins, these things are a necessity and too much can be a bad thing. But because I don't eat processed foods in a box, this is my healthful way that I am choosing to supplement myself. Like I do a lot of different things in my life to avoid supplements. For example, I put on magnesium cream, or I take Epsom salt baths, or I eat kelp salt. So this is what I'm choosing to do instead of having to take a supplement, which would be not an ideal form of the iodine. I just choose to eat kelp salt. You have more science? You've got so much science this episode. I'm like, oh, it's coming. I can feel it.
You know what? And the feedback has been so amazing about, I think we've been just a little bit geekier lately in our episodes. And the feedback has been so amazing. Now I feel like I can't stop. I think where Julie's confusion comes from is that iodine excess is not a guarantee if you have Hashimoto's, but it is relatively common, especially for people who come from a standard American diet. And the unfortunate typical recommendation if you have iodine excess is to avoid dietary iodine. And it's also unfortunate that this sort of like maybe 60% of people who have iodine excess with Hashimoto's. Now, I don't know if that's the exact statistic. I'm just pulling a number out of my head. But it's really unfortunate that that has turned into, you know, for certain doctors, everyone with Hashimoto's needs to avoid iodine because you've got excess iodine. Excess iodine suppresses the thyroid. So what excess iodine is actually indicating is a deficiency in selenium, because as I mentioned in the Science with Sarah segment, a selenoprotein, so an enzyme that part of its molecular structure is selenium, is responsible for dealing with excess iodine. It's also responsible for the conversion, a different selenoprotein is responsible for the conversion of T4 to T3. So selenoproteins are really, really important, and you don't make enough selenoproteins if you don't have enough dietary selenium. And that's why Stacy's strategy of using kelp salt and sea vegetables is so spectacular, because she's getting selenium and zinc and probably on the order of 80 different essential trace minerals by using that as a salt alternative compared to, you know, these other strategies. So, so when you're diagnosed with excess iodine, so if you have your iodine levels measured and it's high, the very next test to ask for is your selenium levels. A more astute doctor will have you supplementing with selenium. And then once your selenium levels are back up, the iodine excess should fix itself. And then you can start working on more dietary iodine. There's also lots of other great unrefined salt options. I use Himalayan pink salt in my house, which has, I believe, 84 different trace minerals, including iodine, but also all kinds of other things like zinc and selenium and iron. Haha, have I mentioned those a few times? Tons of minerals that our bodies really only need in a very small quantity, but then it provides it sort of the way in the olden days you would get from the dirt in your, you know, vegetables that you grew in your backyard, but not very many of us get that anymore. And our soil quality is degrading. So Himalayan salt is a great way to get those extra vegetables, those extra minerals. So is any sea vegetable or any seaweed. Those are just packed with minerals. And so is like Celtic sea salt, unrefined Mediterranean salt. I mean, these are all unrefined sea salt. So they're all rich in different, but you know, a lot of overlap trace minerals. So they're all good options when it comes to just general health.
So I just want to clarify, as I heard you talking, I was like, well, yeah, we use those too. Like there's a difference between cooking salts and finishing salts. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who aren't foodies obsessed with food as much as Sarah and I are, that might be a new concept for you. But I use the sea vegetable sea salt as a finishing salt. It's not something that we cook with. Like, so if you read one of our recipes and it says salt, like you can use one of the many great salts that Sarah mentioned. And then, you know, if you need additional salt or if you choose to use less salt in the recipe itself, then you can add a finishing salt. So like that's how when Matt makes eggs, he doesn't put salt in, he puts pepper in, because I'm able to eat pepper. I'm sorry for those of you still on AIP that can't.
And pepper then, just showed up on my food sensitivity test.
I'm pretending that that doesn't exist for you because it really made me sad. That well, and a bunch of other stuff.
It didn't make me as sad as yeast showing up on my food sensitivity test, which nixes all fermented foods. But that's a topic for another show.
Yeah. Okay.
It just brought the whole mood down, didn't it?
I'm gonna finish it by saying it's delicious as a finishing salt. There you go.
So just slight tangent. I ordered porcini salt today.
Yeah. Was it you that gave me truffle salt too?
That was me. Yeah. I'm a big fan of truffle salt.
You're a big fan of just like umami flavor.
I mean, a big fan of umami. Because who isn't? And that's why I like truffle salt. It's like umami in a jar.
Yeah.
And especially because I think pepper is an umami flavor, and because I have long suspected a sensitivity to pepper, like getting the test result just confirms what I already thought, and the fact that it was pretty high and I almost never eat pepper was a big thing for me. I'm like, okay, so me thinking I'm sensitive to pepper is like a real thing. So for me, truffle salt is just like the most amazing substitute for any time I would use salt and pepper. So that's just an aside for salt geeks out there. I'm hoping porcini salt will be the same.
Listen, we didn't get to be morbidly obese women because we didn't like food.
This is true.
We're in recovery, but we still like food. All right. More questions?
So this one's from Bianca. I love, love, love the show and tune in every week to stay in the loop of what's new in the paleosphere. Following my thyroidectomy in 2009, I put on about 25 pounds. Every time I have visited my endocrinologist since September of 2009, I've been prescribed a higher dosage of presumably thyroid hormone levels. I'm adding that in here, which makes me think that I'm still not functioning at my normal thyroid levels. I began CrossFitting a year ago and have gained a lot of muscle and strength, which is nice, but I still carry most of my fat in my midsection. I am 5'1" and weigh about 150 pounds. I'm a size 6 in clothes and don't look particularly overweight, but I want to see more results. I'd like to know what considerations I should take with my diet since I don't have a thyroid, if any. Also, I'd like to know more or less how much protein, carbs, fat I should be consuming. I'm performing pretty well physically, but I would like to lose that belly fat. Is cardio the best way to go here? Stacey, hold on. Hold on. I'm reining you in.
I'm on mute. Go for it.
Lastly, should I supplement with iodine even if I am thyroidless? Thanks so much for your help, and thank you for the effort that you put into the podcast every week. It's truly a joy to listen to.
Okay, can you answer her simple question first?
So, you know, one of the big tricks when you have either a low functioning thyroid or you have a thyroidectomy for whatever, there's a couple of different health conditions that might cause a thyroidectomy, is to get that supplementation to an appropriate level. And sometimes people are resistant and they just really need high doses, but you have to go slow because if you overdo it, that can be really, really damaging, like to your heart, for example. So you have to go slow, and it's super, super frustrating. I'm doing it now. I'm actually retest my thyroid levels tomorrow, and I know that I'm still way low, and it's having to go so slow is frustrating. And it is the big, I think, common bond that we have in the hypothyroidism or I had something else happen to my thyroid and now don't have a thyroid community is this frustration with tinkering with our thyroid hormone replacement doses. But if it's not working for you, I would maybe read up about what form you're on. And especially with no thyroid, look at something like Armour or Naturethroid, which have the other thyroid hormones as well. So they don't just have T4 or just have T3, but they have T1 and T2 and the other enzymes, because these enzymes like thyroglobulin, you know, thyroglobulin has a role in myelin sheath formation in nerves. So they're important enzymes, not just in the thyroid. So getting your thyroid dose right is probably going to fix things on its own. But also remember that there's other inputs here. So there's stress as an input, nutrient density is an input, sex hormones is an input. So it can get very complex. Should you supplement with iodine? I think we've kind of already answered the question of whole food sources of iodine are really important. There are some cells in the human body that produce thyroid hormones other than the thyroid. So you still do need those minerals to produce thyroid hormone elsewhere in the body, for example, in the immune system, even without a thyroid. And selenium is extremely important. Actually, most of the conversion of T4 to T3 happens in the liver and in the gut. So having those selenoproteins functioning outside of the thyroid, again, become extremely important. So focusing on all of those nutrients, even without a thyroid, really helps. But also continuing to tinker with a thyroid hormone replacement is going to be hugely, hugely helpful. Stacey, would you like to answer her question about cardio?
Okay, so first of all, before I answer her question about cardio, I want to point out what I believe sounds like a healthy person. So, you know, if someone were writing in and they were saying they were 5'1 and 250 pounds, we might have a different response from someone writing in and saying that they're 5'1 and 150 pounds. Also, Bianca is clearly trying to work on healing herself. If her dosage of thyroid medication is increasing since 2009, I would say that she's not yet at a place where her body can handle a large amount of stress, because the whole point of the thyroid medication and where she's trying to be in her health is getting her body stabilized and her hormones regulated so that she can handle and her thyroid can regulate the rest of the hormones that she's got going on. So the absolute best thing in the medical literature for regulation of hormones is not strenuous cardiovascular exercise. So you can do things that are body weight activities, or you can do things that activate type 2 muscle fiber. So that would be anywhere from yoga and walking to lifting really heavy things, which is what I would advocate, whatever your interest is. It sounds like she's doing CrossFit and she enjoys it, but I would also encourage her to really consider if she's not stable and her hormones aren't yet at a place where she feels great, then the cardiovascular activity that's involved in many CrossFit WODs, not all of them, can be too much on a system that's not regulated and able to handle that. So I would not at all recommend cardio, and I would recommend the approach that Sarah and I both took. Sarah did a lot of walking and a lot of yoga before she got into CrossFit, and you know, is working on ensuring that her results are positive and going in a stable, regulated health condition as she's getting back into doing more difficult CrossFit workouts. And for me, I started with, we could call it yoga. I was doing a lot of inversion and hill sprints and, you know, little things myself before I got into CrossFit. And now that I am aware of my health condition, I am actively making sure that the cardiovascular and metabolic conditioning activities that I'm doing are limited and not overly strenuous, and that the majority of the activities that I'm doing as I train for strongman are really activating that type 2 muscle fiber that actually helps regulate hormones, helps improve your metabolism, strengthens your bones, and also just makes you feel really great from, you know, positive endorphin and serotonin response that pretty much any exercising will give you. So
endorphin.
I want to also touch on, I know, Sarah, you probably have something to add to that, but before I kind of wrap up, she specifically asked about what kind of macros she should be consuming, protein, carbs, and fat. Mm. And I would encourage Bianca to first focus on her micronutrients. As we've talked about, there are a lot of nuances with certain deficiencies and things that are connected to deficiencies. So for me, I can tell you I've been tracking my macros at the direction of a doctor this month to see how it affects my overall health. And being able to calculate both micros for nutrient density and macros is really difficult. And I would not recommend that to someone who is not really well versed and comfortable already and making sure that they're getting enough micronutrients, because the tendency for me is to for a lot of people with macronutrient tracking. Well, I really want to eat this cookie, so I'm going to eat this cookie, and then, oh, I can only have, you know, fat for the rest of the day. And that's not gonna help you prioritize health and nutrient density if that's an approach. And I'm not saying that Bianca would make that choice, but I can tell you from 99% of the people that I see who track macros or do something like if it fits your macros, that is the mentality, like that Weight Watchers mentality of you get a certain number of points, right? Like these macros are points or percentages, and I have to carefully plan out my macros for the day so that I get my broth and, you know, the salads and all the things that I need in order to make sure that I'm getting my micronutrients. And then once those are in, then I say, okay, what do I have left to play with in terms of macros? So it's not easy. And Bianca's welcome to follow me. I hate to say this on, MyFitnessPal, which is where I'm publicly sharing the foods that I'm consuming, and you can see my macro breakdown. But this is something that I'm specifically worked with a doctor to come up with the macro percentages that I'm consuming to see how it will affect my health. And we are measuring before I started doing it, and we're measuring it after I started doing it, so that we can see the impact on things like blood sugar and cortisol and leptin. So it's not something I would just recommend that anyone jump into without some sort of education and thought gone into it.
I have nothing to add. I think that was awesome.
Thanks.
Let's do one more question, even though, you know, we're running late as usual. It's like our weekly, like we pretend we have an hour long podcast.
I don't know why we even say that we're running late. Like we,
yeah. It's, you know, it's an hour and a quarter, therefore it's time to wrap up, right? So let's do this one last question because I think it's a neat one. It's from Mark. And Mark says, I have learned that most of the kosher/sea salt on the grocery shelves is not the typical iodine-infused variety. I know that seaweeds have lots of iodine in them as well, and I'm wondering if I can make my own iodine salt by combining these two ingredients.
Look at Mark's smarty pants.
I know. Isn't that cool? I saw some seaweed on the shelf in the Asian/sushi section of the grocery store. Is it as simple as grinding up this kelp and adding it to the salt shaker? Thanks for your time and advice.
Yo, dog. I'm paying money for that. So if you want to do it yourself, I'm sure it works. Although I will tell you that it's less than $2 a bottle for my kelp, for my sea vegetable sea salt. So I don't know how much money you're going to save, but I think it's really, really cool. And you can certainly control the ingredients and know the quality that you're getting if you make it yourself. I do think it's that simple. I'm like pretty positive that that's exactly what's in my can.
I agree that I think it really is as simple as grinding up some seaweed, adding it to some salt. What I think is a ridiculously awesome idea about doing it yourself is there's a lot of different seaweeds. So if like I go to the Asian section in my local Whole Foods, they have dried sort of sustainably harvested from clean waters, right? They've got really high quality seaweed, but they've got six different varieties that I can think of off the top of my head. And so you could actually mix them. You could play with your flavors, and you could try adding them to real salt or Celtic sea salt or Himalayan pink salt. Like you could play with the flavor. And do you like it 40% seaweed, 60% seaweed? Like, I just think that there's so many possibilities just from a palate perspective while also increasing nutrients. I think that's brilliant. And Mark, when you find your favorite recipe, please write back to us and share it.
Absolutely. You can even guest blog it on my site and say how I've been wasting my money for years.
That would be awesome. I would share that. Just saying.
Just only if you shame me will she share it.
So I think we've continued with our Paleo Myth Busting series. I think we
busted some myths.
We busted a number of myths. And not only that, I think we like teased more myth busting, which is even better.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to what you come up with in the future.
Oh, I have no shortage. I'm not going to run out.
Well, it was so cute when we were talking about this being a thing, and you know, your texts to me sometimes are not immediate because you have a life, and my texts to you are sometimes not immediate because I'm in a meeting or whatever. And we were texting and it was like immediately with exclamation points, like, yes, how did you paleo myth busting series? So, and I'm pretty sure that our whole show has actually been paleo myth busters. We're just calling the shows lately.
Series.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I knew once you came back with your exclamation points and I could hear the enthusiasm on the other side of the text message.
Sometimes all caps and exclamation points do the job.
There might have been emojis involved. I mean, it was
almost certainly
the nerd emojis that we came up with. So anyway, yes. Thank you for joining us for this session of Paleo Myth Busting, and I'm sure we'll be back next week with even more topics to bust.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.